Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 13-2977, SCWC 13-2610, and SCWC 14-556, Mount V. Appal. Arguing for petitioners, Frederick J. Arnsmeyer. Arguing for respondents, Mounts, Mary Martin. Also appearing for respondents, Mounts, Michael C. Byrd, and Summer H. Kayabe. Arguing for respondent, U.S. Bank, Paul Alston. Also appearing for respondent, U.S. Bank, J. Blaine Rogers. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Arnsmeyer, Mr. Alston, and Ms. Martin. Are you all ready to proceed with your arguments?
Sure.
All right. So Mr. Arnsmeyer will give you a warning with 10 minutes to go. My understanding on the appellee's side is we've divided the time 20 minutes for Mr. Alston and 10 minutes for Ms. Martin. So a light will come on 20 minutes in and then 30 minutes in. So please proceed, Mr. Arnsmeyer.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Fred Arnsmeyer, and I represent the petitioners Dirk Appal and Margaret Appal. This is another case that arises from a non-judicial foreclosure, a procedure that's proven very problematic in the state of Hawaii over the past several years. We petitioned presenting a number of different points of error in which we allege that the Intermediate Court of Appeals committed grave error. And the first point that I'd like to address is the issue of U.S. Bank's non-compliance with the Hawaii Probate Code. Under the Hawaii Probate Code, there's a specific procedure for making claims against an estate after an individual dies and a probate case is opened. Section 563-803 of the Hawaii Revised Statutes sets forth that procedure. And it requires that a claim be made against an estate within a specific time frame. Now, that procedure exempts any proceeding to enforce a mortgage. So the question in this case all along has been, is a non-judicial foreclosure a proceeding? Well, I believe this issue should have settled a long time ago, as the term proceeding is in fact defined by the probate code to include an action at law or suit in equity. It says nothing about a non-judicial foreclosure or any other sort of procedure or self-help remedy that might occur outside of court.
Mr. Arnsmeyer, assuming that you are correct and that this is not a proceeding, to what extent did that create an injury to your client?
Your Honor, that created an injury to my client because they were wrongfully dispossessed of the subject property, essentially without due process.
Because they didn't receive notice?
Well, the overriding issue in this case was the fact that they wanted to cure the default and reinstate the mortgage, and they were deprived of the opportunity to do that because of not only the fact that this procedure was utilized, but the procedure, in fact, wasn't followed.
In terms of... Okay, assuming that the a non-judicial foreclosure is not a proceeding, and then under is it your position that then 563-803 subsection C would apply? All claims against a decedent's estate which arise after the death of the decedent?
It's possible that a mortgagee could conduct a non-judicial foreclosure against an estate if, in fact, they've made a proper claim and got that claim either way.
Right. So my first question is, we're dealing with 563-803 subsection C, correct?
Right.
Okay. Then in terms of manner of presentation of claim, 563-804-1 says, claimant may deliver written statement, including its basis, name and address of the claimant, amount claimed, or may file a written statement of the claim, with the clerk of the court. The claim is deemed presented on the first to occur of the receipt of the written statement of claim by the personal representative. So is there any dispute as to whether or not Margaret Appal, and as of April 16, 2009, she was still a co-PR, that is there any dispute as to whether or not she received the default notice that was the April 16, 2009 default notice that was actually sent to the home, to the house?
I'm not sure that that's clear from the record. During her deposition, her testimony was somewhat inconclusive on that issue, but I would submit to you, Your Honor, that it wouldn't matter because that default notice alone isn't enough to constitute a presentation of a claim to a personal representative. First of all, there's no evidence on this record that in fact she received it. And even if she did, there was no accompanying affidavit as required under Rule 63 of the Hawaii Probate Rules. In addition, if that notice somehow would, you know, constitute a claim, it was late.
Is there, do the probate rules, it seems a little bit unclear to me under 563.801 whether the notices are to creditors are required or are optional. And I think it's pretty clear that your the notice that was actually published was not a notice to creditors. It was a notice of an informal probate. So is a notice actually required?
Your Honor, the statute specifically states that a personal representative wouldn't be liable for not giving notice. And in fact, if notice isn't given, then the time frame for presenting a claim under the statute is then extended to 18 months. So I would submit based on that it's not required. It simply extends the time frame for the creditor to present the claim.
Okay.
Now, the property was part of the estate, correct or not?
Yes.
And the estate was in probate?
Yes.
I guess I don't understand how the court didn't have jurisdiction. I thought the court has jurisdiction over all subject matter relating to estates of decedents. I mean, I'm reading from 560-1-302. I mean, if the probate court has jurisdiction, how can anything happen without the probate court approving it?
I would agree with Your Honor on that point, although I'll concede that there is concurrent jurisdiction between the probate court and any proceeding to enforce a mortgage.
Right. There's concurrent jurisdiction, but concurrent jurisdiction of the court, another court. There's like a family court or something like that. I mean, the law states that the court has exclusive jurisdiction of formal proceedings to determine how decedents' estates are to be administered, expended, and distributed. In other words, we have a situation, if I understand this correctly, we have a property that's with the probate court. Probate court has exclusive jurisdiction. They're in charge of administering. Somebody else can have concurrent jurisdiction. And all of a sudden, that property can go by the way of non-judicial foreclosure and just evaporate the estate without the court being involved. Is that?
Your Honor, we don't believe that's a proper result under the law. At the very least, we think that a claim needed to have been made with the probate court or with the personal representative appointed by the probate court and then either approved by the PR or the probate court before any non-judicial foreclosure could occur. And in fact, I'm not sure that a non-judicial foreclosure is a proper against a decedent's estate in any event. The best, most safe and proper procedure would be to file a judicial foreclosure action. And then when any issue about reinstatement or notice or things of that nature comes up, there's a judge who supervises the process. We wouldn't be here today had the bank proceeded by judicial foreclosure.
I mean, in fact, that should inform, I believe, or at least affects the definition of proceeding, because proceeding says an action at law in a civil suit and includes actions at law and suit in equity, and that is defined as a civil suit or legal cause of action. It's not some option. I mean, are we defining proceeding to be an option?
Unfortunately, that's what the circuit court and the ICA did. And I submit to this court that the statute's clear. It's not ambiguous. The term proceeding is defined.
Well, Mr. Arnsmeyer, following up on Justice Pollack's questions, then your position would be if the claim had been filed with the probate court, then there would have been an objection, you believe, from your clients to proceeding in a non-judicial foreclosure?
I can't guess what would have happened, but that would have been a possibility. They could have objected. At that point, it would have been up to the probate court to decide whether it was going to allow that claim and allow the bank to proceed by nonjudicial foreclosure. Even were the probate court then to deny that claim, the bank would still have redress insofar as they could file a judicial foreclosure action. Doing so clearly would not conflict with the probate code.
Now, is it your position there was an adequate notice? Because my understanding of the record was that there was a default notice mailed to the property in April of 2009. And at that point, Margaret was residing there. I think she was still the PR at that time, or co-personal representative. So would that constitute sufficient notice such that any error by the court here was harmless?
Well, again, you know, we submit it wasn't a proper claim under the probate code.
In what way was it not proper? I mean, in what way did it not put her as a personal representative on notice?
Well, number one, the face of the document itself. It wasn't mailed to Margaret Appel. It was allegedly mailed to Rose Alvaro.
And that's because the bank had not been told that she had passed away, correct?
Actually, the record reflects that the bank was told as early as 2003.
I see.
That she passed away. And in fact, that's evident in the deposition of James Brantley, the authorized representative of the bank, who acknowledged that the bank knew of her passing as early as 2003, and it acknowledged the probate filing, the notice, in 2005.
So that any error with regard to sending it there was the bank's error, is your...
That's our position.
Well, perhaps you could address your concern that Ms. Lovelace did not receive the reinstatement information that was being requested, because I think the intermediate court found that there were efforts being made by Ms. Lovelace that would suggest that there was information provided, if not to her, at least to Margaret.
With respect to the information that the ICA mistakenly contends was provided to Margaret, again, the record's not clear on that. Summary judgment wasn't appropriate on those issues. What we know is that there was a phone call sometime in February 25th of 2010. This was after Margaret Appel resigned as the co-personal representative. At that time, at best, they gave Margaret an oral statement that wasn't current. James Brantley's deposition transcript will also point out that the two reinstatement quotes that were subsequently generated by the bank, there's no evidence that those were actually ever delivered or given to Margaret Appel, or especially to any personal representative of the estate. In fact, at that point in time, Margaret Appel hadn't been served with the notice of the foreclosure. Neither had either of the co-personal representatives. It wasn't until a year later, February of 2011, when the estate, through its co-personal representatives, were finally served with notice of the intent to foreclose.
But and the notice that they were served with said that the sale would take place on April 1st of 2010?
I believe...
A year earlier, 10 months earlier?
Correct. So apparently the sale had been rescheduled. When Sasha Lovelace contacted RCO initially upon being served to request reinstatement.
Okay, so what is RCO? That's Ralph Crabtree and Olson?
I believe they're known as RCO Hawaii LLC.
And what is their capacity?
They're the law firm that actually conducted the nonjudicial foreclosure on behalf of the U.S. Bank.
Okay.
So when Ms. Lovelace first contacted RCO, she was advised that a sale date had been scheduled for some time in March. Upon her requesting the reinstatement figures, she was told that she would be given those and that the sale would be continued until April 4th, 2011.
Mr. Arnsmeyer, you think the record clear as to whether Ms. Lovelace knew the date of the nonjudicial foreclosure sale?
I'm not sure if the record's clear with respect to her knowledge. It's not disputed at this point that the sale was eventually continued to April 4th of 2011.
So do you have a position as to whether at that time Ms. Lovelace had knowledge that the sale was going to take place?
I don't have any information with that respect.
And she was a co-personal representative at that time?
Right. I do believe she was advised that the sale would be continued. I don't know that she knew that it was going to happen on the date that it happened. I would suspect she assumed, because she hadn't received the reinstatement figures yet, that the sale would be postponed until they obtained that information.
Because, and who is you? Was it Julie? I can't remember the first name. Someone with a, someone with RCO called with the last name of you. On March 7th, she emails Ms. Loveless and says the sale was postponed to March 21st. Have you received your quote? And actually, 3 days before that, she had said, our sale is still scheduled for March 7th, but I'm having the sale postponed for 2 weeks for your reinstatement quote. In other words, suggesting that the sale would be postponed until she received the reinstatement quote.
Yes, that's a fair reading of the record, and it's certainly fair to assume that that's what Ms. Lovelace thought.
But they refused, after the fact, the reason given for not providing Ms. Lovelace with the reinstatement quote was that the lender wouldn't accept the document that had been faxed in February because it had handwriting on it. It was, her name was, Margaret Apollos crossed out, and her name was inserted. The second letter is testamentary. So they wouldn't accept her as the co-personal representative. And that's the reason given for not providing the reinstatement figures. Is that correct?
That's the reason. I don't know if that was true at the time or if that's an argument that was subsequently.
I'm kind of confused, though, because then why did Mr. Wong have her served on February 3rd, 2011 as co-PR?
That's a good point, Your Honor, that she was served specifically as the co-personal representative. If the bank thought...
So RCO recognized her as the co-PR.
Correct.
The attorneys did, served her, yet the same office is not providing her with the reinstatement information?
Correct. Even though she provided them, contrary to what the ICA said, not only with the bank account number, but with the actual document appointing her to that position. And had the bank had any issue with the authenticity of that document, they have local counsel. Local counsel knows enough to go on Ho'oliki to examine the document. If they need to, they can go down to the courthouse and actually look at the original. It's not uncommon, as Your Honors know at all, for judges or court staff to make handwritten edits to orders. It happens probably more times than not.
Isn't that one of the reasons, in fact, that the statute was enacted, to have attorneys so to not have problems like this? I mean, maybe a layperson wouldn't know that something that was changed by hand couldn't be valid. But as you indicate, that's not, you know, that unusual. And it just seems that the legislature passes a statute, they require to have a lawyer to make sure the proper people get noticed. They get a document and then they dispute it. They get a valid document and they dispute it.
The legislature saw the need for requiring local counsel, eventually requiring them their name to be on the non-judicial foreclosure notice, exactly for that purpose. Borrowers in non-judicial foreclosures would be served with the notice of intent to foreclose, and they'd call these mainland servicers and just be put through, you know, the ring on the phone and never get information that they were looking for. So the legislature responded and made a new...
Mr. Arnsmeyer, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you're talking about the obligation under the statute to provide information, in this case of the personal representative, and it looks as though there was some effort to provide information, right, because there was communication between Ms. Lovelace and the billing assistant, Julie Chihok, and Julie Chihok was the assistant to the, I guess, counsel for the bank, and she was working at least with the counsel for the bank. So the reason I'm bringing this up is there was some communication going on between the bank and Ms. Lovelace. What happened? Do you have an idea why it is that the information was not given to her in a more timely basis? Was there some issue because they thought that Margaret was representing her as a personal representative, or what was going on?
I really don't know. I don't have any knowledge. It could have been purely a mistake. You know, RCO, like many other local law firms, were handling volumes and volumes of these non-judicial foreclosures. It simply could have slipped through the crack. But in any event, Section 6675C1 specifically provided that upon request that information must be provided. And as this court knows, if a foreclosing mortgagee doesn't comply strictly with the procedures set forth in 6675, this court has held that the sale is void.
There's a lot of argument I saw in the briefs where the argument is, well, she was negotiating with the other co-representative, that she really wasn't that interested in the information. Does that change the requirement in the statute? You know, what the reason was somebody may seek the information? What is, does the statute depend on what's in somebody's arguably mind?
The statute, it really doesn't take into account what somebody's motives are. And as far as somebody who's appointed as a co-personal representative, they have a fiduciary duty to represent the beneficiaries of that estate. And if that co-personal representative subsequently resigns, the estate has the right to rely on her actions and her conduct and the things that she did when she was serving in her fiduciary position. So regardless of whether Dirk and Sasha, you know, were having issues with respect to how the estate should be administered, they were both in charge of acting in the beneficiary's best interest. Simply because they had a dispute has no effect whatsoever on whether Sasha Lovelace would be entitled to obtain the reinstatement information that she requested.
And actually, about a year earlier, when Margaret Appal was apparently orally receiving reinstatement information, the reinstatement amount was about $72,000, and then later on it was about $80,000, correct?
I believe that's what the record was.
And this property was assessed at over $3.5 million?
That's correct.
The mortgage was $500,000. And was this the only mortgage?
I believe there were some junior mortgages.
There were junior mortgages also. Okay. So did anything come to the estate from the $1.2 million sale?
Interestingly, there was about $30,000 left over in proceeds from the sale after the estate's debts were paid.
I'm just curious. It's a little unclear to me what relief your client might be requesting in this case.
Well, number one, my clients, they're seeking to get their property back.
So you are seeking to have the sale set aside?
Yeah, we believe the sale's void and that the decisions of the lower courts should be reversed.
Does the lower court first have to determine whether the person who purchased the property is a bona fide purchaser?
That would be a potential issue on remand. That was an issue that was argued but never decided below. And our position is that these sophisticated foreclosure buyers couldn't have been bona fide purchasers, number one, because of their knowledge of the process of buying foreclosed property, and more importantly, number two, because under Hawaii law, when the property is occupied, any purchaser is charged with a duty to inquire whether the property is occupied, and if it is occupied, then they're charged with knowledge of the claims. So they can't be a bona fide purchaser. In this case, the property was occupied by Margaret Appal at the time that the Mounts purport to have purchased it.
So your remedy would be vacate the sale, your clients go back in the house, damages would be vacated as well?
Damages and attorney's fees would be set aside.
And it is your position that your counterclaim is not in the nature of a sumpsit?
Our counterclaim was in the nature of tort.
Okay. But your third-party complaint against the bank is not in the nature of a sumpsit?
No, it's not. I will concede that we had count three, which referenced the violation of the mortgage. However, 6675C, which was our main contention, violation of that statute, requires that the bank do all acts and give all notices as required by the mortgage. So the mortgage in this case required reinstatement figures. It required notice. So in our counterclaim and third-party complaint, we pointed out, you know, here's the statute. In addition, these requirements of the mortgage weren't followed. But there's a number of issues as well with the question of attorney's fees. Number one, the Mounts got an award of attorney's fees against Margaret Appal, who wasn't even a party to the counterclaim.
There was no apportionment either, was there?
There was no apportionment or no effort to apportion.
What was the counterclaim against the mounts again? What was the causes of action in the counterclaim?
Well, the nature of the counterclaim was essentially non-judicial or wrongful non-judicial foreclosure. The act of pleading itself.
Did you plead quiet title also?
I don't recall whether we pled quiet title.
Okay.
Mr. Arnsmeyer, would you anything further, or would you like to reserve your time for rebuttal?
I'd just like to make a couple of small points on the issue of attorney's fees. In addition to the fact that Margaret was never a party to the counterclaim, the estate had no contractual relationship with the mounts either. So to the extent that the estate, through Dirk Appel, was held liable for attorney's fees based on an action in the nature of a sumpsuit with the mounts, there was no contractual relationship with them. It was erroneous for the court to award attorney's fees pursuant to 607.14. With that, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for
thank you, Mr. Arnsmeyer. Mr. Alston.
May it please the court, Paul Alston, appearing for U.S. Bank, the third-party defendant. My mission this morning is to address three questions: whether a presentation was made, whether a presentation was required, whether the bank violated HRS 667-5, and finally, I will touch on the issue of attorney's fees. Going directly to the point raised by Justice Pollack, their argument is in fact based on the definition that is provided in Section 1201 of the Probate Code. But the fact is that the Probate Code used the word includes as inclusive, not as limiting. When the drafters of the Probate Code intended to limit the breadth of a definition, they used the word made, or they used the phrase includes and excludes, as they did with child. If you look at the definition of lease, for example, in the Probate Code, it says lease means oil, gas, or other mineral lease. Now, that clearly couldn't be the only type of lease that's affected by the code. It is simply a description of some kinds of proceedings, and in effect it says includes but is not limited to.
Well, except that under proceeding, the definitional section has two types of proceedings. It has a definition of informal proceedings, and it has a definition of formal proceedings.
Right.
And the informal proceedings are those conducted by an officer of the court, and formal proceedings are those conducted before a judge. So the two examples of proceedings, neither of them would include a non-judicial foreclosure.
There's informal proceedings, there's formal proceedings, and there are just proceedings. And our proposition is that proceedings means includes but not limited to suits and includes other things which are fairly characterized as proceedings. And I would note that you know, this court has referred to non-judicial foreclosure proceedings. The legislature in Chapter 667 has referred repeatedly to non-judicial foreclosure proceedings. The federal district courts have done it. The Ninth Circuit has done it. It is simply a commonly accepted use of the term proceedings to include. And I would note that in 2012, this court adopted rules for conversion of non-judicial foreclosure proceedings. So it is certainly appropriate for a lender to believe that proceedings includes non-judicial foreclosure proceedings and to proceed that way.
Well, except we also look at, when we define something, we look at the statute, we look at the definition, we apply principles of statutory construction. When we look at words like use, usually they're words that are defined are exemplary or signify the type of things that are inclusive. We also look at principles of statutory construction, which one of them that comes to mind, the meaning of a word is judged by the company it keeps, or words of a feather flock together. And when you look at that, I don't see how an auction is like a action of law and suit in equity.
Except that, again, if includes is to be read as the context of the definition indicates, as something that includes but is not limited to those things, then the question is, are there, you know, what other types of proceedings are permitted? And again, when this court, the federal district courts, the Ninth Circuit, have all referred to non-judicial foreclosure proceedings, it is certainly appropriate to conclude that the legislature intended it to have the same meaning that is reflected in the judicial decision.
So if an estate owned a car and there was a car loan that fell into default, to enforce the car, a lot of times these car companies self-help and take the cars back, right?
If there is a valid security.
Right, case, right.
That's right, because that's what 803D exempts, is proceedings to foreclose on security interests. And that's all that was being done. If there was a claim for a deficiency, then the code clearly contemplates that the creditor at that point comes back to the probate court and in proceedings before the court addresses the entitlement to a deficiency. But there is nothing that indicates that proceedings to enforce security interests are to be done under the auspices of the probate court.
All right. With respect to the reinstatement, what is your position as to why would she not have been entitled to the reinstatement figures?
Several arguments there. First, in fact, the record reflects that earlier reinstatement figures were provided both orally and in writing in March 2010. Although Mr. Ironsmeyer says that the figures provided in February were in 2010 were out of date, in fact, the record shows that this is at, I believe, volume 9, page 210, that they were figures that were valid through March 3rd. The question comes, how many times does someone who's a borrower get to ask? If a request for reinstatement is made and responded to and made and responded to, does a borrower get to ask again and again until they get to somebody who, like the person in this case, is not fully informed?
Is that a question that should be decided as a matter of law in summary judgment? I can see your argument. It seems to me that it occurred to me that, you know, there must be some sort of limitation, but I've wondered how a judge, as a matter of law, could decide something like that.
Well, I think two questions are presented there. One is, on this record, was it appropriate to decide that? And I think the answer is yes, as a matter of law, because the record reflected that Sesha Lovelace was represented by a lawyer. When she had difficulty satisfying the request for information,
the statute is governed by whether or not somebody has a lawyer or the lawyer follows up?
Well, from the standpoint of demonstrating whether there is any good faith basis for demanding the reinstatement figures a third time, I would submit so.
Because it seems to me you're switching. I mean, the statute requires to have an attorney be obtained or retained by the mortgagee, and you're putting the onus on the other foot. I'm not so sure that that's the intent of the statute.
Well,
it says shall.
Yes, and in fact they did in both in writing and orally provide the figures.
So, and that was only effective until March 3rd of 2010. So then you're saying the estate could have relied on that, and if they had paid that, the bank would have accepted it, and everything would have been fine April of 2011.
Frankly, that goes beyond the record. I can't say what they would have accepted, but I can tell you that in this case, Dirk Appau, a mortgage broker himself, was clearly in a position with what was provided in 2010 and the default notice and the notice of intent to foreclose, which stated the accelerated debt, it could easily have been calculated by him.
I thought in your briefs you argued that she wasn't entitled to the notice because she didn't provide sufficient documentation.
we noted that she didn't provide documentation upon request. I think in fairness, the record would reflect that the bank and RCO, some parts of the bank and RCO were aware that she had become the personal representative. Unfortunately, the clerk who she was in contact with in early 2011 was ignorant of that fact, okay?
And
so that's not, and so our argument really is that she had the opportunity to mitigate this problem by responding. She and her lawyer didn't. And the record through the deposition of Mr. Rapp reflects the fact that there was apparently some plan to do nothing, and then to litigate this issue after the foreclosure had occurred.
You're taking one sentence out of one response where Mr. Rapp says, I think you followed up. I think you're making a very global general or conclusion based on, and actually, if in fact didn't comply, is one prohibited from waiting?
From the standpoint of coming into a court and asking for some sort of equitable remedy, absolutely. Well, from the standpoint of mitigating damages, absolutely.
We're talking about disputed facts then again.
Well, we're talking about the nature and extent of the remedy. But here, the point about Ms. Lovelace was that by her own admission, she was not acting in her capacity as personal representative with an interest in the estate as a whole when she was trying to get those figures. She was acting at odds with the interest of the estate for the benefit of herself and her branch of the family only, because she was interested in how the settlement was going to come down or whether the settlement was going to come down.
Well, so you know, maybe if she had gotten the information and had been able to speak to her attorney, as you indicate, perhaps she would have been advised as to her duties as co-PR. But so now you are conceding that she was entitled to the information.
I think we have to concede that. I mean,
thank you.
The record reflects that there was some knowledge within some branches of the bank and RCO that were aware of that. But I think the other point is here, the record reflects that the estate had no money to cure. The estate had no plan to cure, and Dirk Appel, who was in charge of the finances and moving the one moving things forward, was doing absolutely nothing. The record also reflects that Ms. Lovelace and Dirk were not in communication. They talked twice.
Well,
weren't coordinating in an effort to try to do anything here.
Mr. Olson, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but since you were on the issue about the intent at this point of the personal representatives, and in particular, what was the understanding, do you think, of Ms. Lovelace at the time that the property was sold? We had some discussion earlier about whether she actually knew the date of the sale. I suppose that would be some indication of the extent to which she is receiving information from the bank and the bank's attorney, but do you have a sense of that?
My sense is that the record is muddled about that, frankly. I don't think I can't point to anything specifically that shows she was aware that the sale was going to happen on that particular day. I don't think, but by the same token, I think that record reflects she didn't care. What she was interested in at the time was that her settlement was going to happen.
Can you help me with that? You said she didn't care. Now, it appears from at least the chronology of communication where she's asking for information that right up to a point in time, not too long before the sale of the property, she's asking for information. Now, it's your sense she didn't care about when it was actually going to be sold, and you've heard that some representatives of the bank or the bank's attorney were telling her, and they were discussing it being postponed. So it seems like that was a live issue with her. So what's your sense of the extent to which the information was being given to her about the sale? And I'm sure you concede that she was certainly entitled to get that information.
I admit that there was incomplete information. But I think that her testimony shows that her interest was not in doing anything with respect to saving this property, but it was in doing something. It was in making sure that the settlement that she had arranged for herself and her immediate branch of the family was going to go through. She wasn't engaged with Dirk to try to save the property. She wasn't engaged to try to cure the default. She wasn't engaged to do anything like that. And if she were in a position to do that, she had the means through her lawyer, and Dirk had the means through his lawyers, who are representing him today, to speak up and get information. They don't do anything to mitigate what's going on because they don't plan to do anything.
Doesn't our statute require compliance? And if you don't comply strictly with the statute, it's invalidated. You don't look at the reasons whether or not it was potentially harmful. All the reasons that you're coming up with are, well, it wouldn't have mattered if you'd gotten the information.
Well, in fact, Your Honor, the notion of absolute strict compliance is both out of step with the majority of jurisdictions and unsupported by the cases that people commonly refer to as imposing that requirement.
Lee, you don't think Lee stands for that? And there's a recent Ninth Circuit case that also interprets our law and says actually there's two types of authority out there. There's the strict compliance states and those with general, and we're with the strict compliance.
And I understand. And the Ninth Circuit is the Keiko'oha case, which I'll come back to. With respect to Lee, the issue was, could a lender foreclose on somebody who was not in default at all at the time of the auction? It doesn't require invocation of a strict compliance test to say, no, you can't foreclose on somebody who's not in default. That's the notion that Lee stands for the proposition that any sort of technical violation justifies setting aside a sale is simply unsupported by the facts of Lee. There could be no more significant mistake by a mortgagee than to foreclose on somebody who's not in default. That's not a strict compliance state. Keiko'oha does, in fact, read the Silva case to support a strict compliance test. But if you go back and read Silva, what Silva talks about is not strict compliance with a statute, but strict compliance with the contractual power of sale.
Speaking of the contractual power of sale, then, I'm just curious. Your sale was originally scheduled for April 1st of 2010, and it was actually sold April 4th of 2011. How many times was your sale continued?
I do not know. I do not know the answer to that. The record doesn't reflect how many times.
But, Mr. Alston, following up on your analysis about maybe the relaxing of the standard that should be applied in this case as to compliance with the power of sale or compliance with the statute, would you relax it to the point where it would just simply be a technical violation to not provide the date of the sale of the property?
I would only if in fact there was some indication in the record, some possibility supported by the record, that the mortgagor had any interest or ability in curing the then outstanding default and preventing the foreclosure of the property.
How is the mortgagor supposed to figure it out if they don't even know how much they're supposed to pay to get it reinstated?
Well, in this case, two things. In this case, the record doesn't support that. I mean, they clearly knew as of a year earlier what was required. They clearly knew what the payments were, and they clearly could just do the math. I mean, it's not hard to.
So we're talking about like $120,000 or so.
I think the monthly payments were smaller than that.
I don't think
the increment was that.
So it's actually like $100,000 then.
Doesn't this estate have
substantial assets, actually?
What's that?
This estate actually had a lot of other property, too.
It did, and those were the properties that Ms. Lovelace was trying to get and take for her family.
It had a lot of other property.
Right.
And who knows what would have happened in terms of the equities, as you say. Who knows what would have happened if they had the information?
Well,
and they realized, and she was advised, and the estate was advised, that if you allow this foreclosure, non-judicial foreclosure auction to proceed, this $3.5 million house might go for $1.2 million. You might lose $2.3 million in equity, so maybe it might be worth trying to get a $100,000 loan, even at outlandish interest rates, to figure something out.
And when Dirk Appel, represented by Mr. Dubin, who was by all accounts the most experienced foreclosure lawyer in Hawaii, has $3,400 in the bank, and when Durga Powell works for Finance Factors as a mortgage broker, you can bet that they all knew that that was what was going to happen if they didn't take some action. From the time they got the notice of default in 2009 until they got the reinstatement figures in 2010 and all the way up to 2011. This was not a calamity that befell them, that fell out of the sky and surprised them. They had years and years to do something about it.
In terms of your, in terms of the sale, what is your position, your client's position as to the lender's obligation to obtain the best price?
I believe that the lender has to act reasonably and in good faith to handle the process in a way that complies with the statute and doesn't, to go back to the earlier case, involve any sort of machinations that would suppress bidding by saying, gee, there are too many potential buyers here. I'm going to postpone this until I can come back when nobody's here. But remember, this, unlike judicial foreclosures, in a non-judicial foreclosure case, there is no deficiency. And in many, maybe most...
You don't think that the loss, potential loss of $2.3 million in equity is something to be considered?
I have to acknowledge that's something that has to be taken into account in the process. But here, there's no evidence that they did, that the process of sale itself was flawed in any way. It's true that after cooperating and giving them information...
They didn't give notice to the co-PR as to the date of the sale. That's not deficient under 667-5? They didn't provide the co-PR with reinstatement information. That's not deficient under 667-5?
Those flaws in this context where the record reflects deliberate inaction by Sesha Lovelace and her lawyer with respect...
I'm sorry, but what about the acts of the bank in not providing the reinstatement figures, not notifying her of the date of the sale?
The question is, those things happen?
No harm, no foul?
No harm, no foul.
I see.
No harm, no foul, precisely because we can look at the record that created by the fact that they had the notice from 2010, and Margaret acknowledged that she got the notice. Margaret, who actually had been impersonating Rose, calling up saying that she was Rose and wanted, she was the borrower and wanted information. Margaret admitted she got notices.
How are borrowers supposed to know who they're supposed to speak to? It's very confusing here. Are you supposed to speak to the mortgage servicer? Are you supposed to speak to the attorney? Are you supposed to try to contact the bank directly? I mean, it's like notice is given, she's dead. Mm-hmm. But people that, and it's in your files, but there's no, I guess some people don't know that Ms. Alvaro has passed away. They don't know they're dealing with an estate. And so apparently Margaret just keeps calling, pretending like she's the deceased.
And that bears on this question. I mean, can a borrower, exploit what is apparently miscommunication within the structure of the lender until they get somebody who doesn't follow through after they've already been in contact with somebody who did follow through? And
that's why the legislature required lawyers to do this. Legislature required lawyers to do this, so it'd be done correctly.
Yes, and. Where there is some snafu, it is certainly possible to see circumstances where it's necessary for a court to say that can't happen, that was bad, that can't happen. But
the bank has two other alternatives. They could use the other non-judicial foreclosure procedure, and they could use judicial foreclosure. So if they're really concerned that there may be a problem, they have options.
And again, you can certainly posit circumstances where what happened was unfair because the borrower was completely confused, completely misled, and unable to go forward. Here we know that wasn't the case. We know that the bank did provide information. We know that the borrower was represented by very able counsel. We know that the estate had no money. We know that the estate might have had some credit, but we know by inaction over a period of years that they were not interested in taking any efforts to try to salvage this property. And so whatever could be said about some other case, you can't say it about this case on the record where this borrower did nothing when it could have, when this borrower's lawyers did nothing when they could have. And instead we're faced with trying to unscramble this egg some years after a sale, which would be inequitable.
Mr. Alston, anything further before we hear from Ms. Martin?
Yes, just very briefly on the issue of attorney's fees with respect to the bank.
Very briefly.
There are two strands on which that claim for attorney's fees rests. One is the assumption statute. The other is that there is a fee provision in the note which provides that the lender is entitled to fees in any proceeding involving to enforce the note. I would submit that.
Does that only benefit the lender?
Well, under the case law, of course, when there is a fee provision that benefits one, it benefits both. I acknowledge that. But here, what we have is claims that did implicate the note and the mortgage. And below and on appeal, they've made no argument for apportionment. They've made no argument for sort of teasing apart the fees. It's an entire win or lose proposition for them. Because they did have some assumption type or note related claim, they're stuck for some fees. If they wanted to argue it was too much, they could have done that. They didn't do it, so it's not appropriate for this court to take it up and save them from their own failure to argue what they should have argued about apportionment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Alston. And Ms. Martin, we cut into your time a bit with some of the questions we asked to Mr. Alston, so I will give you some additional time when that red light goes on, if you need it.
May it please the court. I would first like to, Mary Martin, on behalf of the Mounts, who are the third-party purchasers at the foreclosure auction. It wasn't the bank buying at the non-judicial foreclosure. It was a third-party purchaser. So obviously, there had been publicity about the auction. I would like to touch on arguments and points that were raised earlier. Mr. Arnsmeyer wants to allege that my clients were not bona fide purchasers of this property, and the two points he raised is that they have knowledge of foreclosures. They've done bidding at foreclosures. That doesn't mean that they are not third party, they're not bona fide purchasers. They bought in good faith, they bid at the auction. There were several bidders, I believe is shown in the record. So there's no question that there was not actual bidding.
Is that conclusive? Even if I believe the circuit court never ruled on that issue because she didn't have to, based on the way she ruled. But even if your clients are bona fide purchasers under the law, doesn't Lee versus HSBC Bank say that the process should ensure that properly conducted sales are final between the parties and conclusive as to bona fide purchasers? In other words, I think it's pretty clear that based on this and the authority that they've cited and the cases that they cite are cases in which sales to bona fide purchasers were actually set aside because the non-judicial foreclosure sale was not conducted properly.
You're going back to the Lee case, which has been discussed a couple times, and that one is limited on that specific issue of the fact in Lee that auction was conducted when the borrowers were not in default. And so it's a narrow holding.
But actually, you know, when you look at the heading, it says, holding a non-judicial foreclosure sale void where sale was invalid under HRS 667-5 is consistent with the purposes of the statute. It doesn't appear to me that this case is trying to limit it to the specific facts of that case.
And actually, Your Honor, you're raising a good point, because in the lower court proceedings, early in the case, the attorneys who were representing the Mounts at that time did file a motion for summary judgment on that specific issue, and it was ruled at that time that a bona fide purchaser defense was not going to stand to the challenge to the non-judicial foreclosure, on the question because there was still a question of whether it was void or voidable. And that's where this court, I believe, is going to have to put their attention, is if there is a question of how it was conducted, is it actually void or is it voidable? And Mr. Olson has been addressing the question of whether or not it was a valid auction, and I would defer to his arguments on that point. But yes, it is a question. If it was truly void, then yes, there is a problem. And when it comes to the question,
I noticed that your client, compared to some of the non-judicial foreclosure sales I've seen, actually got a limited warranty deed.
Yes, that's correct.
And isn't that somewhat unusual?
To my knowledge, yes. But generally, they are quick claim deeds. In this case, he was given a limited warranty deed. I don't have the facts as to exactly why that occurred, and he also got title insurance. I understand that is not the normal process or the normal expectation, and a lot of the title companies in Hawaii are having a problem with that. And that's an issue, because in these foreclosures where there's an appeal filed and no supersedious bond is posted, then in large cases, the banks are the ones that end up holding titles to the property, waiting for an appeal to go through. They're not going to go ahead and try and resell the property because there's an appeal pending. So title companies aren't going to give title insurance, and it puts a stagnant process. There's stagnation in the whole process, and so there's a lot of properties, as I understand, that are wending their way through until an actual appeal is determined, even though there's no supersedious bond posted. And in this case, there's no supersedious bond posted. I wanted to make one other point on the bona fide purchaser piece. Mr. Arnsmeyer suggested that my clients should have known that there was a problem with it because the property was occupied. But two points. One, in a non-judicial foreclosure context, there's no open houses. So nobody's going to actually see the property. If, presuming they drove past it and saw that there was a car parked there, that's not definitive of it being occupied, or more to the point, that somebody's going to actually fight this foreclosure.
And under Part 1 non-judicial foreclosures, there's no open houses. Under Part 2, aren't they required?
I would have to go back to the statute and review that. I'm not absolutely certain on that, Your Honor. I think you're right, but I don't have that in front of me. But this was technically a Part 1 foreclosure. The next point that I would like to address from the earlier arguments is this issue of whether the counterclaim was completely in tort. Now, the counterclaim and the third-party complaint were the exact same thing. It's the counterclaim and third-party complaint. It's not distinguished between U.S. Bank and the Mounts. It is one pleading that is directed at both of them as a counterclaim and third-party complaint. So if it is a action in the nature of a sumpsit, then it's a sumpsit against both parties. And indeed, I believe the counterclaim says, unlike judicial foreclosure, a non-judicial foreclosure.
What paragraph?
We're in Volume 1, page 103, paragraph 21 of the counterclaim third-party complaint. Unlike judicial foreclosure, a non-judicial foreclosure sale is entirely a contractual remedy. And therefore, to undo it is for a breach of contract. And further on in paragraph 13, volume 1, page 91, these answering defendants maintain that the alleged non-judicial foreclosure and subsequent transfer of title to claims was conducted in violation of binding contractual agreements, including that certain mortgage.
What paragraph was that again?
I believe that is paragraph 13 of the answer to the complaint.
Oh, answer to the complaint.
Yes.
Okay.
So they've laid it out themselves. It's in the nature of contract, and it's in the nature of assumption, and it was alleged against the Mounts as well as against U.S. Bank. And in order to defend or to proceed with their action in ejectment, they had to defend against the counterclaim. They weren't going to get these people out until they had a decision that it was not a wrongful foreclosure. On the point of whether Margaret Appel should be...
So you filed a quiet title action for, and your counts were ejectment and quiet title, as I recall.
Correct, and I believe we added the quiet title because originally the ejectment was started in district court, which is the typical place to file an ejectment action. And once a question of title is raised, then it's kicked out of the district court and moved over to circuit court, or you have to refile in circuit court. And at that time, quiet title was alleged at the same time.
And then you sought damages.
Yes, for the ejectment.
Okay.
Sought damages for the ejectment, and then when there's the counterclaim in a sumset.
Damages based on loss, having to rent someplace else.
Well, that was part of it.
And your attorney's fees.
Yes.
And your client's attorney's fees.
Yeah. Okay. Damages, a bulk of the damages was.
It was about $200,000?
Yes. It was rental of an alternate place. And there's a question that was raised as to whether that rental was, or that those damages should have been based on the actual rentals of another place versus what the Appel parties argued was the fair market rental of the...
And the judge went with the rental of the other place?
Yes.
Which was a lot higher than the fair market value of the rent of the premises?
Well, about $2,000 a month. And if that's an issue, that's an issue. But it is an abuse of discretion review, and having an absolute receipts, proof of the lease, and how much they were actually paying for the other place versus an appraisal of fair market value for rental of the subject property, then you've got actual versus.
Ms. Martin, if you could, come back to the bona fide purchaser issue. If this court were to find that the statute had not been complied with, 667, in terms of the notice given to the personal representatives here, what then would be the implications for your client, or what inquiry should take place at that time?
That's one of the questions that counsel has been throwing up in the air and going, we don't know exactly what's going to happen, because that would go back through various issues as far as whether the entire thing gets unwound, going back to the title insurance company. Our client, as noted, had a warranty in their title and has title insurance. If it is totally void and the entire nonjudicial foreclosure were to be undone, then our client would be seeking damages for their loss. It would be totally inequitable. They've been holding on hope and waiting for more than 2 years. Are we going on
damages for the loss from whom? From whom?
Well, that's a good question. At this point, it would be between the title insurance company and the bank to figure out as to who would be liable for any damages incurred by the mounts at this point in time.
Fortunately, your client has title insurance and has a limited warranty deed.
Yeah. But go down that road,
most of these are quitclaim deeds.
Yeah. But to go down that road would be wholly inequitable.
And what's your basis for that? In other words, what if you would just summarize your argument with regard to the conclusion that we should not, for example, send this case back with the direction that they'd be put back in the house. That's what they're asking for.
That's what they're asking for, but Your Honor,
I assume you disagree with that as a remedy, and if you would just capture why. If we were to find that this sale did violate the statute, does that mean they go back in the house, or is something short of that possible?
I think there's two alternatives. One, yes, they could. That would be one of the alternatives, is they would go back in the house. The second would be a suit against the bank for damages, for their own damages.
Their own damages, meaning the Appel's damages.
Yes.
I see.
That would be the alternative.
Very well. Anything further you wanted to address?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Ms. Martin. Mr. Arnsmeyer, your rebuttal.
I'd like to touch on a couple of points raised by Mr. Olson. First of all, he cites to the Lee case and points out that in that case, that you know, it's distinguishable because at the time of the foreclosure, the loan had been brought current. That's exactly what the intent was here with requesting the reinstatement figures, to bring the account current. There's a procedure in the statute that allows for that. The Lee case really isn't all that distinguishable at all. Had those reinstatement figures been provided, perhaps the estate would have brought the loan current, and then had the foreclosure gone through anyway, it would have been the exact same scenario. Mr. Alston's position that the estate had no interest in curing or no ability to cure, that's disingenuous and absurd. The estate had plenty of other assets. Both PRs were interested in preserving the estate. That was necessary as part of their settlement between themselves. And that's correct. Dirk Appel works for a mortgage company. I think the record clearly reflects that. He's actually got a lot of contacts, and the record may not show it, but he certainly was making efforts to obtain financing or refinancing on other properties which could have been used to cure in this case.
I'm sorry, the record, what does the record reflect in terms of what efforts were made by the plaintiffs to try to cure in this case? Does it reflect anything?
The record clearly shows the efforts to obtain the reinstatement figures.
Beyond that?
Beyond that, I believe Dirk may have discussed during his deposition efforts to obtain financing. I can't recall the specifics of that through my personal knowledge.
And how long were they in default on the mortgage?
Well, I believe the default letter reflected...
The default started in early 2009, and the letter was...
Right, the letter was 2009, probably April 16th. 7 or 8 months after the default. Right.
Okay, thank you.
I thought they conceded that the default started in early 2009, not 7 or 8 months before April of 2009.
I'm sorry.
I thought the bank represented that the default started in early 2009, not 7 or 8 months before April of 2009.
Right. I don't have the recollection of the specifics of the letter, but if, you know, Your Honor would look at the letter, it's clear on the face of when it started. It was many months before that letter was sent out. I think also one important point that deserves further consideration, even assuming that Margaret Appel got some information in 2010, it's undisputed that at that time, no personal representative, and in fact not even Margaret Appel, had been served with the notice of intent to foreclose. I would submit to the court that the procedure with respect to 6675C1 is triggered upon the PR being served with a notice of intent to foreclose. That's how the non-judicial foreclosure is started. How would they even know to ask that question until they're served and until the record reflects that they knew that the non-judicial foreclosure had been noticed? In this case, almost immediately after the estate was finally noticed, of the foreclosure, almost immediately those reinstatement figures were requested. You know, we heard a lot about what might or might not have happened, and you know, standing here before you today, I can't answer any of those questions. Would they have cured? Did they have access to money? We don't know, but it wasn't appropriate to foreclose those possibilities on summary judgment. There were certainly genuine issues of material fact. Finally, with respect to Lovelace's intent, what was her intent? I submit to the court that her intent, it's irrelevant. And even if it were relevant, that's a question for summary judgment. You cannot ascertain what Lovelace's intent was through this kind of a process. Again, she was in a fiduciary position. Both her and Dirk Appel had an interest in preserving the entire estate, both of them, all of the parties, all of the beneficiaries benefited from that.
How would a ruling, I think this court has repeatedly said that mortgage is an equitable remedy, and we have discussed equity abhorring forfeitures. in this, we must consider the impact or import of the remedy that you request in this case in terms of the overall scheme of what happens. What happens to all of those people with who bought these properties under quitclaim deeds? Their remedy is against the lender?
Potentially. But in the case before the court right now, there's an alternative remedy, as we pointed out all along. The Mounts in this case got title insurance. They can be easily made financially whole if the property is returned to the Appels. Whether or not there's future litigation between the Mounts and the bank, so bank over damages, well, that's between the bank and the Mounts. We submit that the bank was at fault in this case. There's a specific procedure. It needs to be strictly complied with. It wasn't complied with. The estate was deprived of its ability to bring the loan current, like in the Lee case. And as a result, they've lost their inheritance. They've lost several million dollars. They're left with nothing that they were required to pay. They're still trying to come up with the money to pay for the estate tax, yet somebody else has their house. The result in this case is clearly inequitable. Equity can be achieved by a remand, and for those reasons, we request that the court reverse the ICA, remand this case to the circuit court with instructions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ardensmeyer. Thank you to all of our attorneys for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.